I played basketball because I liked it. It turned into a job where I made a living. I would still play basketball today if my body would let me. It's a great sport. I loved it. It's kind of the first love of my life. When I tell people, how do you get good at something? You got to love it. You got to have the passion to do it. And I did. I like to think I got just about everything I could out of my body. It paid off in a lot of ways.
And you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Kicks it off and there's number 23. And of course, Johnny goes nuts.
So we're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you made the pass. Yes. Christian, can you catch the ball? Yes.
All the stars were aligned and all the muscles fired at the right time. And I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 107. Thanks for joining me. I'm very happy to welcome three-time NBA All-Star and two-time Sixth Man of the Year, Detlef Schrempf. We discuss his formative years in Germany and the foreign exchange program that would change his life forever. We cover his standout tenure at the University of Washington, the ups and downs of his early pro career with the Dallas Mavericks, and the 1989 trade to the Indiana Pacers that ultimately allowed his game to shine. Detlef talks about his return to Washington State, where he played six seasons for the Seattle Supersonics, including a trip to the NBA Finals to take on Jordan and the Chicago Bulls, before closing out his playing days with the Portland Trailblazers. Show notes for this episode and access to a huge archive of past episodes are available at inallairness.com. Now, onto the show. My guest today was a large part of the first wave of European-born players to make their mark in the NBA. He's a two-time Sixth Man of the Year, a three-time All-Star, two-time Olympian, and a 16-year NBA veteran. Detlef Schrempf, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you being on the show today. Now, per basketballreference.com, you were born in Leverkusen in Germany.
Yeah, born in Leverkusen. Parents still live there.
From what I understand, as a young boy, you played another round ball sport before basketball became your main calling.
Everyone in Germany, as soon as you walk, you start kicking a soccer ball. So that's what I did until I was about 13 years old before I switched over to basketball.
I think that the reason for changing over to basketball may have also came about due to an injury that you sustained.
I would say it was a combination of things. You're in a group of guys and change positions. You're not happy with what's going on. You're not really enjoying the guys. And at the same time, I picked up basketball in high school. And I think I sprained my ankle really bad. So it was a good time to kind of take some time off from soccer. And when I went back, I went to join a club, a basketball club. And that's how I kind of got started with it.
One of the newspaper articles that I read preparing for today stated that until about the age of 13 or 14, you really hadn't seen a basketball game before. So what was it that drew you into the sport and made you change your mind from playing soccer primarily?
Well, at that age, you have all kinds of other issues. So I think for me, it was just somewhere I found something new that was challenging. I was kind of good at it right away within a few practices. So it gave me some confidence. And I just literally just took it from there. I took it for about a year and a half. I played it a lot, but not as much as I did after that period where I had some success and realized, well, I could be actually pretty good at this.
What height were you at this stage when you're 14, 15 years old?
Yeah, a little taller than normal, but not really as I am now, obviously. I grew really late as a teenager, so I made some huge jumps when I was 16, 17, 18. And I think that really helped with developing as a basketball player because I didn't start as a forward or center. I started more as a ball hander.
I read that you were the MVP of Club Leverkusen in 1979 and 1980. So you're barely 17 years old at this stage. How did you develop those skills so quickly, do you think, and what made you stand out from a young age?
Whenever you're successful or had something, you're not quite normal. I took that a little bit to the extreme. Once I had the bug, I was practicing with two, three teams, playing on two teams. Thinking back in those days, if you played on a team, you only had practice maybe twice a week. If you're lucky, three times a week, because that's just the way things were. So I practiced on a on a men's team, like a Division III team, and I practice on an older junior team just to play more. And I was very fortunate to have a coach that embraced that, who was really kind of one of those forward-thinking coaches, did a lot of things that other people didn't, plyometric training and really socially getting the guys together and creating that culture. It was just something that I really bought into, and it appealed to me. Before you knew it, I was practicing basketball every day.
You headed to America as part of a foreign exchange program, and I read that you originally had planned to go to California. However, a club basketball friend of yours suggested that perhaps the Pacific Northwest, where he'd visited, I think, a few years earlier, might have been a good choice, and you ended up in Washington State. When you turned up, what was it like?
The team I played on was kind of like the Boston Celtics of Germany. They won like 10 out of 12 championships, a semi-pro team. And we had two players that were from UCLA that played with Bill Walton in the championship years. So they were like, we got a school for you in LA. I can't remember what it was, Inglewood or something. And you got to go there. That's the perfect place for you. And I was like, yeah, well, I need the coach's address or somebody. I need to write a letter. I need to apply for a student visa. I need to get all this stuff so I can go. And typical kind of, I thought maybe LA boys, they were like, yeah, man, I'll get it to you. And before you knew it, it was like, okay, I have like 3 weeks before I got to get some stuff going here. And then this Centralia High School in Washington, my backup basically was, well, a player that was on the first team, he had gone there 2 or 3 years prior. So small town, great coach. Yeah, it was a fun experience. So I literally wrote the coach as a backup, hey, I'm interested in coming. I did the math, centimeters to inches. I was telling him like, I'm like 6'4". And he writes me back, love to have you. Here's all the paperwork. Well, then like back then it was snail mail. So 2 weeks later, I had all the stuff. I got my student visa and I was set to go. And then obviously he was very surprised when I showed up and he looks at me and goes, you're not 6'4", because I've done the math wrong.
So what, you were probably about, 6'7" or something, were you?
Yeah, I think it was like 6'7" and 3/4", almost 6'8".
Oh, wow.
And grew some more my freshman year in college, too. So,
how did you find the adjustment when you got over there? Your English, how well did you speak it and how quickly did you pick it up?
I realized my English was very insufficient. The typical high school British English that you learn in Germany, everyone was talking fast and slang and basketball terms. And yeah, I walked around with a dictionary the first month. But when you have to speak it all day and that's all you can speak, you pick it up fairly quickly. It was good. It was a small town. I came from a larger industrial town era where Bayer Pharmaceutical Company, Bayer Aspirin, that was our hometown. So a lot going on. And you go to a small town of 25,000 people, which was basically a freeway stop. It was a big change in that regard.
It's incredible how fate seems to play its part sometimes. And you're looking at possibly heading to California and then that doesn't happen and you end up in a smaller area where you end up having a lot of success, which in turn sets you up for really a massive change for the rest of your life.
Yeah, life works out.
It does indeed. Centralia High School, the Tigers, I believe they were called, went 25-1 in your senior season as a high school player and averaged about 16 points a game, including in that season you won the 1981 Class 2A High School State Championship, defeating a team called Timberline, I think it is, 52-43. And in that title game, you had 24 points and were named the tournament MVP. So how do you look back on that amazing one-year run?
That was a great experience because my high school coach, Ron Brown, he just retired. He coached at the same school for 52 years. Wow. He was an institution, coached the same way. He coached 50 years ago until like 3 years ago. He ran the same place. He had every player run all the plays, understand all the positions. So he was kind of old school, but he also taught basketball the right way. By the way, we went undefeated. That one loss was in a preseason game to a AAA school, and we had half our team missing that played in the state football championships. We also won the state championship in football. So we had half the team missing in a preseason game.
I'm glad you corrected me. Thank you for that, because it said 25-1 in the newspaper. That's fantastic that you went undefeated.
Yeah, it was awesome. We won every game by over 20 points. So I think I played second most on the team, which was like 20 minutes, which was a fun run until the state tournament where the starters played most of the minutes. But it was a great year where we had small town and everybody's in the gym for each game, which It's packed to the ceiling, 1,800 people or so that fit in there, and 2,500 people are in it. So it's a great experience from a basketball standpoint because you could barely fit that many people in a Division One game in Germany at the time, right? If it was a big game, if you got 1,000 people, you were pretty lucky with that, you know.
Are any of those games that you played in as a high school player, do they remain on videotape or DVD or something? Have you ever seen any highlights of yourself back when you first played in America?
Oh, yeah, I've seen some clips from the state championship game and stuff, yeah. It's funny how, you know, skinny and also almost looked like a white and black movie, but it's pretty good. But we had a good team, and again, back then, Washington State was one of the last states to have a shot clock, so it was every position was well thought out. That's why the scores were 60 to 50 or 70 to 60 if you're lucky.
Is it true that you were also a very good high jumper back when you were in the high school track team? I read something about that as well.
Well, I was fairly athletic. I had no technique. It was basically, we didn't have a high jump coach. I think we finished second in state, though. I ran, I jumped, and I turned. Watched it on TV and go, you gotta do this, right? Let's see how that turns out.
Multi-talented. In 1981, you also found time to play for the West German junior national team. And on that team, one of your teammates was Christian Velp, who would be a future college teammate of yours. Sadly, Christian passed away in 2015. He was only 51. To this day, though, he's the all-time career leader in points scored at the University of Washington. If it's not too personal, do you mind just describing your relationship that you had with Chris and what impact he had on you?
Well, Chris was one of those teammates that was pretty quiet, played great basketball, never seemed like he enjoyed to play basketball that much because he wanted to go fishing or hunting. Some people said he didn't work as hard as he could have. He could have been great. He had a great career. He played in Europe. He played 14, 15 years in Europe. He won a bunch of championships. And I think he was good enough to play in the NBA. Probably went to the wrong team, got drafted by Philly, and hurt his knee the second year or first year, and then never went back. Yeah, since he played in Europe for all those years, we were never really that close. We saw each other in the summertime every once in a while. And then actually the funny thing was just before he passed, his son was playing for his high school team for the state championship, and my son was coaching his former high school team at the state championship. So,
wow.
So it was kind of, people always come back together, basketball communities, a small community. So very unfortunate that he passed, and he should be in our college hall of fame. And hopefully we can get that through because he was arguably the best player that university ever had from a statistical standpoint.
Yeah, well, when I was looking through the record books of the college, his name's littered throughout it as much as yours is. So he's definitely made a big impact there for sure. Interestingly, you initially hadn't even anticipated staying in the USA once the exchange program had ended. So I was stunned when I read that. How did the opportunity to then receive a college scholarship with University of Washington come to be?
Yeah, I had planned on going back and playing in Europe, financing my college that way, because back then you could make some money, but it wasn't that you can make it your career because eventually you had to work anyways. But then when I was finishing up, I was high school, I was getting some interest from schools to play at the college level, and I never really thought much about it because I thought I still had to go back to Germany to finish my high school diploma there, right? I still had 2 years to go. But then I found out that if I go here to college for 2 years, it would be equivalent of finishing my German high school diploma, you know, which is called Abitur. So I go, well, maybe I should just try it. So I had a couple offers, nothing major. Ended up visiting a Boise State and a Montana State. And then last minute, the University of Washington came in and said, hey, we got a spot open if you're interested. And I drove up to the school and checked it out. And that was the end of it.
It's fascinating how these things end up coming to be and what could have been had you headed back home again. As a freshman, your Huskies went 19-10 and then bowed out in round two of the National Invitational Tournament. How did you find the adjustment from high school to now playing at college, Detlef?
It was a change. I was a pretty skinny kid in high school. I was always skinny. And then you get to the next level and the 6'8 guys, they're about 30, 40 pounds heavier than you. From a basketball standpoint, I really enjoyed it. It was challenging. Every day you had practice. It was organized. And I loved the weight room. So we had a great, you know, weight coach. And that's where I spent a lot of time. And I enjoyed it. The classes, going to school was okay. I didn't embrace it like I should have, but I did okay. I was more focused on basketball. Maybe not the first year, but after that, for sure, my sophomore, junior year.
with your sophomore season, your production and minutes basically tripled from your previous season. You went 16 and 15, and you averaged almost 11 points, 7 boards, and more than 1 assist a game. How did it feel to make a bigger impact on the team individually in that second season with the Huskies?
My freshman year, we had 5 or 6 seniors, so they all left, and all of a sudden we had a team that was competing every night to basically, we had, a sophomore, and I was the next player that had the most minutes. So we kind of struggled that season, but we had some success, but also played poorly as a young team would. So the season was over quickly, no playoffs. It was definitely a learning experience because we were young and the young guys had to carry the team.
Your Huskies went 24-7 in your junior campaign, and you had a 21 rebound game, I noticed, against Idaho in December of 83, which is just one shy of the all-time record at your school. In February of 1984, your coach, Marv Harshman, he said of you, "Detlef is the heart and soul of our club. He's just gotten better and better since he got here. When he doesn't have the ball, we suffer offensively." You were Pac-10 co-champions, I believe, and made it all the way to the Sweet 16 in the NCAA tournament. You had a 23-point, 13-rebound effort in a round one win, and then you had an amazing 30-point game against Duke, which you beat Duke by 2 points. 21 points were in the second half. Now, you eventually were upended by Dayton in the Sweet 16, but looking back on that junior season and taking part in the tourney, what springs to mind there? Some great achievements.
We had a senior point guard leader who's been around, who was a really good point guard in Elton Vaughn. And then our class, or the class behind me, we had some good size and young talent and a couple forward players. And then obviously Christian Welp joined us. So he came on board. Now we had a legit 7-footer. And I think the tallest team maybe in the country. We started 7 feet, 6'10", 6'9", 6'6". Had some great size, and we took advantage of that. It was a fun time because we won a lot of games, and we surprised people, and then we made a good run into the NCAA playoffs.
What about that game against Duke? Does anything particularly stand out from your memory there? That was a fantastic effort to beat them by 2 points. I think they were the highest-seeded team as well.
They had great players. They had a great season. Our tournament was, I want to say, at Washington State. So we had a lot of Huskies, alumni, and fans that came over and watched it. We played a great game. I don't think I missed many shots. And overall, we all controlled the boards and did a great job. And it was a fun win. And wish we had won the next game because we should have, but they had a couple of guards that surprised us. Because the following game was against Georgetown, and that would have been a fun matchup against them.
Now, prior to your senior season, you played with West Germany in the 84 Olympic Games in LA. One of your teammates was Uwe Blab, and he played collegiately for Coach Bob Knight at Indiana the same 4 years that you were with the Huskies. Now, you were a standout individually at the Olympics. You averaged almost 19 points and 8 boards, actually 3 assists a game as well. You had a 36-point game against Brazil, but you went 2-6 overall. I came across this quote from an article whilst I was doing research talking about your experience, and it said, "Guys over there play basketball as a hobby. I got mad at some of the players. We didn't get along." When did you last reflect about those 1984 games, and what did you make of the experience?
Chris was probably youngest. I was the second youngest on the team, but I was, you know, the high scorer on the team and high rebounder. And we had a little bit of an older team, guys that played in the German leagues for a long time or played in Europe for a long time. And we started out well. I think then we ended up playing the U.S., which was so favored, and we only lost, I want to say, about 9 points. And the guys were happy about that, and they went out and hit the town and celebrated and said, "Oh, we're in L.A., never been in L.A., let's go out." And then we dropped a game we shouldn't have against somebody in the next game, and that would have put us in the medal round. And I was kind of pissed because they thought, well, we don't have a chance to win a medal, and we played a good game, so let's call it good. I didn't get along with them well at that point. That was a little bit of a hothead.
You did play Team USA, as you mentioned, in the quarterfinals, and you top scored, I think, for West Germany with 16 points. What was the atmosphere like to play against and compete so well against a team which were all but assumed to just go ahead and dominate every team and win the gold?
I don't remember all the details. I think we played well. We were close, but never could get over the hump to kind of make a push for it, and they had a lot of talent.
In terms of your senior season, you were named the team captain and the Huskies went 22-10. You were the Pac-10 co-champs again and went to the big dance for a second time. However, you exited with a round one loss to Kentucky behind future NBA player Kenny Skywalker, who had 29 points and 10 rebounds. What do you remember of your last season in college and that final game particularly?
It was a little bit of an up and down year because we didn't have a point guard. Our point guard graduated and we had a couple of freshmen that played some, but we started without a point guard and I played point forward. It was a challenging year and I sprained my ankle really bad. Halfway through the season, we played at Duke. That probably set me back, made it a pretty slow season where I couldn't practice for about 2 weeks and just played the games. We were not playing as well as I had hoped for senior season. Kind of limped into the NCAAs, not very healthy, not playing well, and it showed in the first round. Our coach was pretty sick. Coach Harshman was sick, and he missed a couple of games. It was not a season where you kind of go, well, we finished really on top. We kind of limped through it.
Just to put a cap on your college career, you missed only one game, I believe, in four seasons, and you're left with averages of almost 12 points, more than six rebounds, and more than two assists a game. And at the moment, as it stands, you're 16th all-time in career points. You mentioned Coach Harshman there. I believe that that final season of yours was also his last season as a college coach, and he retired. What sort of impact did he have on you over the four seasons that you played with the Huskies?
He's a great man. Coach was old school, but he was just a great human being, well-respected, very loyal, someone you can really look up to.
In mid-April of 85, you took part in the Aloha Classic in Hawaii, and you're a part of the West team, I believe, and you played alongside guys like Terry Porter and AC Green, one of your rivals during the Pac-10 years in college. In a victory over the Midwest, which included players like Sam Vincent, Ty Corbin, and Xavier McDaniel, I read that you had a 24-point, 10-rebound, 4-assist game. There's a quote I read from Terry Porter, which is, "I've seen him play many times on TV. He can play," in terms of talking about you. That win, coupled with an East loss, meant that you won the round-robin tournament before the final night. You were named the outstanding player of the tournament, and you were also on the all-tournament team with guys like Harold Keeling, Joe Dumars, Xavier McDaniel, and Terry Porter. With the NBA draft only a few months away, obviously that would have helped bolster your stock in terms of being known by all the scouts and whatnot. What comes to mind when you think about the Aloha Classic?
It's a fun tournament because I'd never been really to, you know, Hawaii before. So to be able to go to Hawaii and play basketball, and then I think I stayed a couple extra days. It was very special. For me, it was playing with some of the guys that I competed against, but also playing at a different level where everyone was that good. So it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I played a couple other All-Star games that summer. Back then, you were encouraged to do those things. Nowadays, most of the guys that get drafted first round don't really participate. I don't know if it helped or hurt my stock, so I think it was fine.
Speaking of the NBA draft, the Dallas Mavericks selected you with the 8th overall pick. You rocked a tuxedo on draft day, looking very good there in front of the cameras. How did it feel as you walked on the stage and shook hands with the commissioner and hearing your name called?
It was fun. I got dressed up. My agent said, it'll be kind of cool. Everyone's doing something. Let's wear a tuxedo. And I go, okay, whatever. I had some good feedback on it. For me, the draft was a little bit of a surprise because I got drafted by a team I never talked to. I interviewed with most of the teams in the top 10, except for Dallas, New York, which had number one pick. I visited three teams and got interviewed by the rest. Dallas, I never talked to, and they ended up drafting me. So it was kind of interesting. I didn't even know who was on the team.
In that draft, Dallas actually picked three foreign-born players with each of the first three picks. Bill Wennington from Canada and Uwe Blab from Germany, of course, and yourself. In terms of your career in Dallas as a rookie, you played 64 games and you had action in all 10 playoff games. The Lakers eliminated you in round two. Just looking back on that rookie campaign, what stands out most about your transition to the highest level?
Had some good moments, had some bad moments. Didn't enjoy playing for the coach. He was old school. He hated rookies. He messed with you all the time.
That's Dick Motta.
Yeah, it was an adjustment. Some games I played a lot of minutes and then didn't play for two games. It was very inconsistent and there was no rhyme or reason, which was hard to take as a young guy, a little bit of a hothead, thinking, why am I playing today and I'm not playing tomorrow? It took a couple of years like that before things changed.
When you say he messed with you a bit as far as the younger players, do you have an example of anything that you wanted to make mention of?
Oh, he'd tell you You better be ready tonight. Play a lot of minutes because this is a good matchup for you. And so you go back to the hotel, get ready to roll. You show up and don't play a single minute. And no explanation.
Wow.
Then you don't play two games. And then all of a sudden they'll tell you, put you in 2 minutes into the game and you play the whole first quarter and you're dying because you haven't played in 5 days, really. It was kind of interesting. But that was old school. That was back then. There were a lot of coaches that didn't like rookies and they messed with them. They're kind of trying to break you in.
Well, it's almost counterintuitive, though, to do that, I suppose, and then throw you in the deep end when you're not expecting it. Thank you for sharing, though. I do appreciate it.
Different times.
Yeah, absolutely different times. Yeah, these days, I don't think they'd cut it. The coach would be probably sent packing pretty quick. In 1987, the Mavs had their best season in terms of record. You went 55-27. The Sonics defeated you in the first round of the playoffs. But I'd just like to ask you about the All-Star weekend in 87. You almost upset Larry Legend in the final round of the three-point shootout. Had you made your last shot, I think it would have tied Larry's score. Not only that, the event was actually held in Seattle Coliseum, not too far from where you played your high school and college ball. So what were your memories of the All-Star weekend and taking part in the three-point shootout, which obviously would have helped raise your profile amongst the other players, I'd imagine?
It was fun. Player first All-Star experience and back home in Seattle. So it was great. It wasn't the big hoopla it is now with parties every night and all kinds of events. It was basically All-Star Saturday and the All-Star game. There wasn't much else at the time. But it was great. I enjoyed it. I saw a lot of friends, needed a lot of tickets.
Oh, Detlef, please, can I have a few tickets? Yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine. Now, in 1988, the Mavs advanced to the Western Conference Finals, and you took the would-be NBA champion Lakers to a seventh and deciding game. You averaged just under 20 minutes a game that season. I've read a few articles that suggested that you were not overly pleased with your lack of regular minutes, which you've just mentioned, of course. When you look back on your time in Dallas, how frustrating was it trying to establish yourself, given that you had the opportunity to succeed sometimes, and in other times you were just stifled on the bench by coaching decisions?
We had a lot of talent, the two guys in front of me that were all-stars, and then players that played behind him, like a Dale Ellis, my first year, who became an all-star. So there were a lot of good players, and I think the times waited too long to make the right moves. So guys were not very happy. I know Dale was not happy. I know Jay Vincent was not happy. Then you had power forward position with Sam Perkins and Roy Tarpley. There was some issues there because Roy Tarpley was very talented, but had then eventually drug issues. So there was a lot of stuff going on at the time. And also within the team, there were a couple of guys didn't respect who the guy was getting most of the shots, what was going on. For me, it was just consistency. There was none. One day I would play all the minutes. The next day, Dale Ellis would play all the minutes. It was very inconsistent in that regard.
It would have made things very difficult, I can only imagine. Now, after appearing in 37 of the 49 games to start the following season, the Mavs traded you to Indiana with a future second-round pick in exchange for Herb Williams. Were you aware of the possibility of a trade, or maybe you were hoping for a trade at that stage, but how did it feel to have a fresh start and get sent to the Indiana Pacers?
I did not know about a trade. They had just traded a week before Mark Aguirre, who I played behind, and I was starting the last two games, and I thought, oh, finally, I'm getting the minutes. I broke my ankle in the Western Conference Finals, so I was laid up most of the summer, and I was just coming back and starting to feel good. Basically, I called into the coach's hotel room, and he said, we just traded you. You're going to Indianapolis. So we were in Denver, and I took a flight the next morning, flew to Indianapolis, and never went back to Dallas to our home, never saw it again, and played a day later in Indianapolis for the Pacers.
Wow, so that came about real quick.
Yeah, that's how it is.
That's the nature of the NBA, I guess. The Pacers went 28-54 in that 1989 season. They went through four coaches by the time the season had ended. The 1990 season, though, was your first full one with the team. You made the playoffs but lost to the eventual champs, the Detroit Pistons. You're also playing alongside a young Reggie Miller. That was your best individual season to that point. 16.2 points, 7.9 boards, and 3.2 assists per game. And the Pacers obviously were a franchise that was on the rise. How did it feel to be a part of a team that was an up-and-coming franchise that you could certainly develop on as you're heading towards your prime?
Well, I was a little worried when I got traded there because the team was 11-28. Or 29, I'm going, wow, at least they know when they're going on vacation, the day after the season is over in April. But I've been in the playoffs every year before that. Yeah, I think I was in the playoffs every year after. It was a change, but we had a young team, and the good thing is we had guys that like to play and work. So I went back to Indianapolis early in the summer, and we played and worked out together every day, the core of the team. And it showed the young team came around and all of a sudden made the playoffs, which was very unexpected.
Your coaches for that time in Indiana, I think you had Dick Versace for most of the time and then Bob Hill. How did their coaching strategies and approach compare in terms of what you experienced with Dick Motta back in Dallas?
Versace was interesting, but he let me play, which made it easy for me. And Bob Hill obviously helped my career a lot because he let me do the things I was good at, rebound, push the ball, make things happen, break plays. And I was able to handle the ball a lot, make passes and kind of run the offense through me. So yeah, I enjoyed playing for both of them. Dick was a different human being. He was strange, but I enjoyed playing for him.
Yeah, he seems like an interesting character. When I've seen him back in the 1980s and 90s on some of the TV telecasts where he's involved, he's certainly a unique individual and has a unique personality, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Bob Hill is a former guest of the show and is a really nice guy, so I'm pleased to hear that you got along with him well. Now, in 1991 and 92, you won the NBA Sixth Man of the Year Award. Just a tremendous achievement, clearly. You're one of only five players in history to win the award two or more times. How important were those honours given your reduced role that you had in Dallas earlier in your pro career? And even just more generally, looking back, you know, where do you sort of rank winning the award twice in terms of what you've achieved overall?
Well, I think it takes someone special to come off the bench and produce every night because you kind of take a little bit of a hit to the ego and keep yourself in check. And I struggled with that before. But at that point, I knew before the game I was going to play most of the minutes. I knew I was going to get 30-plus minutes every game, which gives you confidence that, hey, it's all right. I figured, hey, I just embrace it. And I knew that when I come in the game, I can basically run with what I was able to do. I just do what I wanted to do and go push the ball and make things happen.
In 1991, in the playoffs, you had a classic series against the Boston Celtics. It was an epic five-game battle, which culminated with Game 5 in Boston Garden. You had 20 points in that game, and Chuck Person exploded for 32, but Boston escaped with that win after Larry Bird came back famously after hitting his face on the parquet floor. What stands out most about that series, or even particularly that game, just the intensity level and the crowd, how amped they were?
I remember Chuck having a good game and talking a lot of smack to Larry. And Larry struggling physically. I think he had a bad back, so you could see him walking not straight. But he's still, I don't know, he's still out over 20. And then, yeah, him diving on the floor, splitting his chin open. And then I think someone else hurt us. I can't remember who it was. Maybe Derek Smith or something had some big buckets. But I remember, here we are, we had a chance. We gave it away at the end. And like 3 seconds to go and no timeouts left, and they inbounds me the ball for after they made a free throw, and I'm like 90 feet away, and they go, well, if this goes in, we have a chance. And I had to throw one like halfway, like sideways winder that didn't even hit the whole basket. You know, like, wow, that was a prayer. That was an exciting game. The Garden is always exciting to play at. Yeah, we had our chances, but we're inexperienced, and we lost to Detroit the year before. We lost to Boston. All-Stars have been to the finals and won championships.
The Pacers went 40 and 42 in 1992, but before you lost out in a rematch to the Celtics. You also took part in the Olympic Games that year with the German team. You went 3-5 overall, but you had an outstanding tournament with 23 points and 10 rebounds per game. What springs to mind about the Olympic experience in general the second time round in Barcelona?
We had a pretty good team, and again, we lost the cross game for the medal. So I think we finished fifth. We could have been in the medal round. But it's hard. It was a long season, and for NBA players, and for me, I had to go back and do the qualification. I was in Europe for like 3 weeks to qualify for the Olympics, and then go back and go to training camp and then to the Olympics. We had a baby, and my wife was like 8 months pregnant, and so it was really hard because I was gone for basically 6 or 8 weeks before she had a baby. So we're in Barcelona, and we're in the village, and the U.S. team, the dream team, is staying at the Ritz-Carlton. They're playing cards, and they're having room service, and we're 12 of us sharing a four-bedroom condo with two showers. you're in the NBA and you're traveling in style in a charter and staying at, you know, nice hotels, you come there and you kind of are back to an amateur, right? Which is fine because that's how all the other, you know, athletes were living. But it's hard when basketball is the first sport there and the last one to leave, all those team sports. It's a long time in the village. And then there's a lot of people that have one event and they come in, it's the second day, they perform and then they stay and party. So it's really hard to rest up in the village.
Yeah, I can imagine it would have been difficult.
It's a great experience. It was the first time Germany was unified. So we had a lot of time sitting outside at night talking to different athletes from different countries, even from former East Germany. And it was cool.
You were named one of the NBA's top 24 players in 1993, and you appeared in the first of three NBA All-Star games in Utah. When you heard your name introduced for your first All-Star appearance, how did you feel coming out onto the court, just experiencing the fact that you were one of the best players in the world at that period of time?
That's satisfying because you put in a lot of work and all of a sudden recognized for something. I was still pretty young, just my third year, fourth year of really playing consistent minutes. Statistically, I had a great year because they ran the offense through me, so I had the ball in my hands a lot. But again, that was right after the Olympics, and after that season, I was pretty worn out and had to have knee surgery. It was a long two seasons and the Olympics and playing a lot of minutes. I played sometimes back-to-back 48-minute games. It took its toll, but it felt great that a team counted on you to make things happen, so I enjoyed it.
You mentioned your individual season with the Pacers. You had 19.1 points, 9.5 rebounds, and 6 assists per game, which is just fantastic. According to Basketball Reference, you're a top 20 in total NBA points, rebounds, and assists as well for the season. Tremendous effort, no doubt. In November of 1993, the Pacers traded you to the Seattle Supersonics for Derek McKee and Gerald Patio. I read the Indianapolis Star article about it, and it said that the trade for you and McKee had been rumored on and off for more than a year, and that the Pacers and fans were stunned with the deal, whilst the Sonics obviously would have been very happy to pick you up to have you on the team. What was your take on the trade and what went down and the move to Seattle?
It was a surprise to me, especially it happened one day before the season started. So I went to training camp. Again, I came off knee surgery and I didn't miss a session in training camp, went through it, started getting in pretty good shape, and got traded a day before the season started. After the evening practice, after 2 days at 9:30 p.m., and I was on a 6 o'clock flight the next morning.
Oh, wow.
So it was just one of those things where they knew about it, but I was a little, you could have told me this afternoon so I can spend the evening with my family, pack up, and leave. But it was pretty much a deal done by Coach Brown, who I don't think like the style that we played before, what was successful, where I posted up a lot. So you wanted to change it. I think he thought that Derek, he fit in better with them the way he wanted to play, where the ball was mostly in other people's hands. And it seemed that it worked out for them. They had a few successful years.
How did you feel to be heading back to the Seattle area?
Well, I think first we're disappointed about the trade because we were told all summer that we're going to stay in Indiana. We stayed the summer there. We had two babies, basically. We had bought a big house, and then basically it was over. So we're a little disappointed about that, but at least I went to a city we call our home. So we had a house there. It was easy to make the transition. It's just that, again, my wife had to stay behind and pack up a big house with two kids and move.
Not ideal. Now, Seattle had a great season in 1994. You went 63-19. I have to ask, however, about your playoff matchup against the young Denver Nuggets, that team that shocked the NBA, defeating you guys 3-2 in the first round. Denver were the 8th seed. You guys were the number 1 seed. A really good series, but again, you're unfortunately on the wrong end of the Game 5 decider. What do you recall most vividly about that matchup against Denver?
I think they matched up well with us because they put Dikembe on Sean Kemp and didn't double team him, didn't do anything, and basically eliminate a lot of stuff that made us successful that year. For us, it was more internally. We had all kinds of issues. Guys didn't get along. They were fighting about minutes, fighting about shots, and it was not pretty, and it showed in the playoffs. I was kind of a new guy that year, the veteran coming in, and wasn't as vocal, but it was obvious halfway through the season that if we didn't fix some of that stuff, it would backfire, and it backfired on us in the playoffs where, as soon as things were going wrong, guys were pointing fingers. So they made some changes in the offseason.
What about to George Karl? How was it to play for George after the previous coaches that you'd gone through with Dallas and, as we described, in Indiana as well?
I enjoy playing for George. He's a little bit of a schizophrenic maniac, but it's easy. You practice hard, you play hard. He has no problems. I enjoyed that. We practiced really hard as a team. We went after each other. And we did the same in games. We played great defense. Anybody guard anybody and help each other out. And it was a fun way to play. We struggled a couple of years in the playoffs. When we needed baskets, we didn't execute well. And that probably was not good. But eventually, we did a little better for a couple of years to figure it out.
In 1995, you were named an All-Star for the second time. You also had an All-NBA third-team appearance. And then you were ranked top 20 in the total points scored again in the season. Just jump to 1996. The Sonics had an outstanding season again. You went 64-18 and you met the Chicago Bulls in the NBA Finals. The Bulls were up 3-0 and then you guys won game 4 and 5 and took it back to Chicago for the 6th game. What was it like to be part of the NBA Finals, and how different was the level of play compared to anything that you'd experienced prior to that?
Well, I don't think the level was different than the series before. We played Utah in a 7-game series, which was very physical, a bloody fight. It literally was. There was a lot of action, a lot of fouls, a lot of physical contact, and it took everything out of us. I think we didn't realize that when we got to the finals, we were still on this high for the round before of beating Utah. That took us a while to get going.
You mentioned Utah there. There's always talk about John Stockton, Karl Malone, how they sort of get away with as much as they can and the refs seem to let it go for the most part. How did you find going against the Utah team in terms of the reputation that they did have for pushing the limits, I guess, in terms of what they can get away with on the court?
Oh, it's always been that. Like, you know, I played against them for 15, 16 years, so I knew what we were getting into. So it was a physical game.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't expect anything less from them. We let them off the hook. We were up 3-1 and let him back in it, but we ended up winning the series. But I think we didn't have that killer instinct in the first two games in Chicago where we could have won either one and we didn't. You know, just kind of limped through the game, lost by whatever, 7-8 or whatever it was, but never really made a run and played very average in both games.
Sean Kemp had a great series for you guys. Arguably was probably a contender for MVP of the finals, I guess. He played outstandingly. How was it to play alongside Kemp when he was at his athletic prime? And what was it just like to have him on the team for those years in Seattle?
Sean was a good teammate, fun to play with because you never knew what would come out of it. He'd catch a lob pass or try to dunk one going baseline. Playing all those years with him, it was exciting to kind of, because you come as a bystander, all of a sudden there's a fast break. And I knew 99% of the time if I was in the other lane, I wasn't getting the ball. Gary's going to throw the ball up there somewhere to Sean, even if I was more open. So I was more focused on, okay, maybe I can tip it in. You know, if he misses it, you become a bystander. When that thing is up in the air, you just kind of look. So it was always exciting, and he was a great competitor and loved to play. And physically, he did things that, you know, people had never seen a 6'10 guy do before.
Gary Payton, how about having the glove as a teammate? He loved to obviously talk and get into the players' psyche and try and get them off their game. What was it like to have Gary as your teammate as well for those seasons in Seattle too?
It was great. I mean, we won so many games. We were so good. We played tough defense. We scared people. We knew sometimes teams were coming in. You can see it in the eyes. They were worried about getting double-teamed and throwing the ball away. And Gary let him know about it. We also had lots of fights and discussions in practice because he never wanted to practice. And we had a veteran team, so there was a lot of that going on. But we always had a great time. I talk to him all the time now. He lives in Vegas, so we're good friends. But back then, we were like, we want to go out there and kill somebody. I mean, that's how teams wanted to do it. So it was a little different.
Appreciate you sharing these stories. Thanks very much, Detlef. As a Sonics player, you averaged about 16 points, 6 boards, and 4 assists a game. The lockout season discounted, you averaged 60 wins per season in each of those full 5 seasons with the team in Seattle. So a great amount of winning there throughout that time. Now, you signed as a free agent with Portland in early August, I think it was, of 1999. And then you guys took the Lakers to 7 games in the Western Conference Finals in 2000. Unfortunately, LA had that monster run to finish out the fourth quarter and stole victory in game 7 there. How difficult was that loss to endure given how close you guys were to advancing to the NBA Finals?
For me, it was very tough because that's the only reason I went to Portland. I had some really good offers elsewhere, but with no chance of making a championship run, maybe a lot more money. But I said, you know, play a couple more years maybe and let's go somewhere where I have a chance to win. And I went to Portland, which on paper looked, you know, really good, tons of all-stars. But again, almost similar to my first year in Seattle, there were a lot of issues with the team itself. We had so much talent. We didn't work hard enough. We didn't have a lot of discipline. And it showed sometimes. It showed in big games. It showed in the playoffs. It showed in the seventh game when things just fell apart. And it was not a fun finish to a season that could have been really good. It was a struggle. But we had enough talent to win it that year, and it just, you know, couldn't execute it when it mattered.
In 2002, fans selected you the top vote getter for the University of Washington's All Century team. Other names that our listener would likely know on that team will be James Edwards, Todd McCullough, Aldridge Kasner, and Chris Velp, who we talked about earlier. You're also a member of the Husky Hall of Fame. In 2009, you were inducted into the Pac-10 Hall of Honor. And I'm sure there's other achievements there I haven't even mentioned. Just looking back on those achievements over the course of your playing career, how does it feel to be recognized for those on-court contributions at all levels?
I mean, it's great. I played basketball because I liked it. It turned into a job where I made a living. I would still play basketball today if my body would let me. It's a great sport. I loved it. And it's kind of the first love of my life. You know, when I tell people, how do you get good at something? You got to love it. You got to have the passion to do it. And I did. And I like to think I got just about everything I could out of my body. It paid off in a lot of ways. For me, it's very involved with the university here. I love talking to the young players and where they're going and what they're thinking. It's a big honor. But at the same time, a lot of these people don't remember me, so it's not that big of an honor. The young generation, they're doing other things. It's all relative. It's good maybe to have your name up there, but they're going to go, who's that guy?
I'm sure that everyone listening to this episode will definitely know exactly who you are and appreciate the time that you've afforded me today. It's been great to have a chance to chat with you. Your charitable work is something that I have been aware of for many years, most notably the Detlef Schrempf Foundation, which I think you founded back when you were still either just in Indiana or had moved to Seattle. You were directly involved for more than 20 years, and the foundation raised in excess of $20 million. Incredible. In advance of our chat today, I was messaging a great friend of the show, Jim McElvone, a teammate of yours from your Sonics days. I don't want to embarrass you, and he doesn't mind me quoting him. He said, I think one of the great stories about Detlef is his philanthropy. A lot of pro athletes try to support great causes with the best of intentions, but many fall short in that goal. Detlef's foundation was one of the best examples I saw of how to do it right, to be successful and make a real impact on the causes he was passionate about. His work has inspired me to emulate his efforts in my community and be as giving as possible to those who are trying to support worthy causes. Those are obviously very kind words to sum up your impact. How do you look back on all the contributions that you've made to the Seattle area, Washington State, and wherever else you've been involved with the great work that you've done over many decades?
Well, thanks. And thanks to Jim. He's a friend, and he's been to many of our auctions and golf tournaments, even though he's a horrible golfer. We have a really good time. When you have a venue to impact people, which I did as a player, I took advantage of it. When I first came back to Seattle, everyone jumped back on. They were like, okay, what can we do? Come open this restaurant. Come do this. We got organized and focused really quickly on how we best can have a positive impact in our community. So that's how we started the foundation. We learned sometimes the hard way what the causes to support or how to not raise money, because a lot of times I had to write a check to cover something that didn't work out at the beginning. But we had a great team. Nicole Morrison, our executive director, was with us from the beginning to the end for 24 years. And we were like a family. And our goal was to have an impact, positive impact on our community. And like you always say, to leave it better than when you found it, right? I took advantage of my name, and I'm not embarrassed about it. I asked people, season ticket holders, sponsors, car sponsors of the Sonics, hey, you want to support my foundation? I need X amount from you, and you get this in return. I never had an issue with that, and they enjoyed it. We put out a great product. We were pretty proud of working with the charities that actually eventually made an impact on the children. We vetted them, and we were very hard on them. They had to show their financials. They had to show what they were doing, how they're impacting kids. because there are a lot of good causes, but money goes to waste for a lot of them.
Well, it's fantastic what you've done over a couple of decades. So congratulations on all you've achieved there. It's really outstanding. You're one of a handful of NBA greats that were on court for Dirk Nowitzki's last home game in Dallas in 2019. On numerous occasions throughout his career, Dirk actually cited you as one of his role models. How special was it to be included in that ceremony? You were there with guys like Charles Barkley, Scottie Pippen, Larry Bird, and Sean Kemp. What was that experience like to take it all in? The crowd obviously were loving Dirk in his final game.
Well, it was amazing. I was honored to be part of it. Dirk, yes, we had some contact, but we were not very close, you know, another generation. But to be included in that group was special. He had just an amazing career. I think what he did for German basketball and basketball worldwide is incredible. A guy coming from a small town in Germany right into the NBA and having a huge impact. So it was special. Plus, the five of us, we were locked up in a suite watching a game that did not matter for 3 hours before, because we thought we'd coming out before the game.
Oh.
We get there and they tell us not till after the game. So we sat there with Barkley in a full bar. So it was quite entertaining. And we weren't supposed to speak. And then all of a sudden, Coach Collett hands us the mic, and we're going, uh-oh, this could be bad. It turned out all right.
You're the last of the five to speak. You guys all spoke really well. It was just a great moment to be able to honor what Dirk has contributed to the game, and to come from great players like yourselves as well. It was a really fitting way to close out his last home game in Dallas. Basketball Digest had a regular feature which was called The Game I'll Never Forget. Is there a game from your career that stands out the most?
Probably game 7 against Utah. We won at home to go to make the finals, which, like I said, it was a really tough series, and there was family and friends, everyone came on the court, and it was pretty special. Where you just like, I'll take that deep breath and go, yes. And then we made the finals. Yeah, we want to win the finals. That took another step, though. So, but it was a huge game, and I think it was really good for the city at the time.
Did you have any particular significance to the jersey numbers that you wore throughout your career? I'm not sure what number you had in high school, but at college you wore number 22 for the most part. Dallas, you wore number 32. In Indiana and Seattle, you had number 11, and then at Portland, you wore number 12. Was there any particular significance to those numbers, Detlef?
No, not really. I wanted a double number. When I was in college, 22 was available, and I took it. Then I get to Dallas, that wasn't available. I think it was Rolando Blackman's number, and they just gave me a number. So then when I got to Indiana, 22 was taken. I wasn't going to take it from, I think it was Anthony Frederick who was there. So I took 11, and that was kind of my favorite number. I took that in Seattle. Tried to take it in Portland, but Savas had it. So I wasn't going to take it from the big 7'3 guy.
Probably a good career move.
Yeah.
I could ask you 1,000 more things, but I won't. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show, and I thank you for taking time out of your day to speak to some guy in Australia. Thanks very much for talking about your career, and I hope sometime in the future we get a chance to do it again.
I appreciate it. Thank you for all your research. You're well informed. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. You can suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. Send me an email. Audio clips are welcome. inallairness@gmail.com. Worldwide, the show now has 161 ratings on Apple Podcasts with an average of 4.5 stars, with 87 reviews across all providers. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways to support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Your word-of-mouth recommendations are worth their weight in gold. Stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply email me inallairness@gmail.com. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. Search for In All Airness, 3 words, on your podcast app of choice. The show is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Android, and more. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallairness.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at InAllAnus. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/InAllAnus. Join me next time for another edition of the show.